screw the Supreme Court. Who cares about the Supreme Court? Says the guy who's constantly lecturing us about how Trump's a dictator. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Steve Hilton Show. Great show today. A guest that joined me yesterday. I'm taping today's show unlike normal. Two different locations, two different days. I've been on the road. I was actually in Austin, Texas, which was amazing to see what's going on there. Really booming. Very interesting. I saw the eclipse. I get into the whole eclipse thing with Jen Horn today. She's our guest on California Corner. We had a great conversation. But a really important one that you'll want to listen to is my conversation with Lisa Smitkamp. She's the district attorney of Fresno County, and she is one of the real movers behind this very important ballot initiative that is poised to qualify for the ballot this year, which is aiming to reform Proposition 47, which has now become notorious across the country because this is the one that was passed under totally false pretenses, which is really driving the explosion in crime, in particular retail theft here in California. There's been this effort from a bunch of district attorneys led by Lisa Smitkamp and a few others as well, to deal with this, and it's going really well, and she's here to tell us all about it, why it's so important. I learned a lot from that conversation, so stay tuned for that. But I want to start today with the big story on two fronts, but it's the same point, and it's to do with Joe Biden. And I've said for years that Joe Biden, I mean, look, I take a step back. I always try and be fair and reasonable, okay? You know me by now. I try and judge things fairly, and I try and be positive and find positive things about politicians, even if I don't agree with them on everything. Try and find things about them that I agree with. But I've always said this very, very clearly. I just cannot stand Joe Biden. Why? Because to me, he is the absolute example of the worst of politics, a totally mediocre, corrupt machine politician who has no beliefs, no principles, no convictions. All it's been about in 50 years of him being in politics is just climbing the ladder, trying to push forward his career, regardless of what the issues are. He doesn't have any views about anything that are consistently held throughout his career. He's been on every side of every issue. And we saw that perfectly this week. The absolute perfection of the coincidence of two things that happened this week. So number one, where they came out again with this policy of debt relief, student debt relief, which of course is a bribe to their voters and just incidentally shows where their priorities really are, which is the reverse of Robin Hood. I mean, as has been pointed out, this policy of student debt relief is taking money from the poor and giving it to the rich, because the people who benefit will be the higher educated and higher earning people who've benefited from a college degree, and it's working people who never went to college who can be paid for it. So it's totally outrageous. It's totally unfair, but it shows you what the Democrats have become, the party of the rich, no longer the party of the working class at all. But that's actually not the main point that I wanted to make today. The main point is, even as they announce this renewed attempt to buy votes this November with this debt forgiveness plan, this scheme that they've put together, they said it very directly. Biden said, you know, openly, I think he was in Wisconsin, and when he was announcing it, the latest effort, he said proudly, the Supreme Court tried to stop us, but we're not going to let that stop us. Okay, we're not going to let that stop. We're going to just do it anyway. Screw the Supreme Court. Who cares about the Supreme Court? Says the guy who's constantly lecturing us about how Trump's a dictator, who's going to destroy democracy. Oh, no, but when it's him and his attempt to bribe people to vote for him in November with his student debt relief plan, screw the Supreme Court, we're going to do it anyway. But then the next day, we see this interview come out. I think it was with Univision, and he's talking about immigration, and he's saying, Biden's saying, well, people are telling me that I can do an executive order to secure the border, which is, by the way, what many of us have been saying for years. Every time they say, oh, he can't do anything because it's Congress's fault and Congress has to act. He just can't do something on his own like this. It has to be Congress and all the chaos at the border. That's all the Republicans' fault because they won't make the right reforms happen in Congress. And we said, well, hang on a second. You're the one that opened the border, Joe Biden, with executive action. So you can close it with executive action. And so for years, they'd be saying, no, 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 can't do that. Now, again, because he can see the damage that it's doing to him politically, they're looking at an executive order that would close the border, which he could have done months, years ago. But now he's finally looking at it. But then in the same interview, he says, although it's possible the Supreme Court might stop us, and then I won't be able to do it. So there you have it, literally in two consecutive days, when it's bribing the elite with money taken from working class taxpayers in order to vote for him, student debt relief. Yeah, we'll just ignore the courts. But when it's the border and the courts try and stop him, that's that. Sorry, nothing we can do. So that just tells you a couple of things. First of all, this guy's got no principles. He's got no convictions at all. He's got absolutely no kind of bedrock of belief. It's just whatever helps him politically. But then the sort of total kind of cavalier disregard for the rule of law, for consistency, for anything. It's just unbelievable. And the hypocrisy and just every single thing about it is so revealing of how utterly pathetic, ridiculous this administration is, led by this person, Joe Biden, who, as I say, is just for me the absolute worst example of everything that is disreputable and disgusting about politics. So for the policy conversation this week, I want to talk about something that actually you may not immediately think of as a policy question. It was a story that took a lot of attention in the media this week, covered more as a, you could say, human interest kind of story. But actually, there really is a policy dimension to it, and a very, very important one. The story I'm talking about is the appalling school shooting that happened. Ethan Crumbly, do you remember, was the shooter, and his parents were previously convicted of manslaughter in the way that they were negligent. And I don't want to go over all the details of what they didn't, most importantly, didn't do, or the warnings they had about the mental health problems of their son, the specific warnings about his, you know, really disturbed mental state, drawing pictures of a gun, blood everywhere, the fact that they bought him the gun, all of those details widely reported. The story this week was the sentencing, and it was really interesting. I remember watching it live. I was in Austin, Texas, as I mentioned earlier, when the judge came to issue her ruling about what the sentence should be. And the prosecutors asked for the maximum allowable sentence, and the victims, in their statements, the relatives of the children that were killed, asked for the maximum sentence, and the judge gave the maximum sentence. And there was a lot of conversation around it in terms of this being a slippery slope legally. They didn't actually pull the trigger. Why they, you know, the sentence was 10 to 15 years in jail. There's going to be an appeal. You know, we'll see what happens. But it was a really, really strong articulation of a principle that actually should be considered a policy matter. The principle is parental responsibility. This guy, I think he was 15 years old. Clearly, the responsibility of the parents. And the broad point here is that if you look at so many of the issues that we more obviously think of as policy issues, whether that's what's going on in schools, what's going on in you know, how children emerge from school ready for the world, whether they're educated properly, trained properly, whether they will fall into behaviors that we'll then have to clean up through the criminal justice system or the welfare system, healthcare, drug, you know, all the problems that you end up addressing in government with policy solutions and taxpayer money, all the kind of programs to remediate things that have gone wrong. Actually, if you had a situation of proper parental responsibility, you could call it universal parental responsibility, where all parents did what most parents actually do, which is to raise their children in a stable, loving home. That is the norm. But there's a large minority now, an increasing minority of children who are not raised in that way, where the parents don't take responsibility, where they're happy to, you know, give the kids a smartphone at some ridiculously early age and sort of basically stick them in front of an iPad as sort of tiny babies, and not give them that kind of human interaction that we know is so vital, reading to them from an early age. All these things are really basic. We really know what makes a difference in raising a healthy child, healthy in the broader sense, physically and mentally. A child that is equipped to go out into the world and be independent and strong and just live a normal life and not require the attention of government in all these programs that cost so much money. And so if we just had a situation where parents were responsible, as I say, like most parents are, then we wouldn't need to spend all this money on these social programs and interventions by the government. And so that question of how you get parents to be responsible is a really, really important one. And I think a lot of the time politicians have said, well, you can't legislate for that. And that's true. Of course, you can't pass a law that will make parents responsible. And so they say, well, there's nothing we can do. You know, that's the way of the world. Society's changing, culture's changing. Parents are like this. They're not getting married as much as they used to and having children without father in the home. That's a whole other issue, by the way. Really interesting conversation that I also taped this week with Brad Wilcox for the Big Ideas Book Club, the new show that I hope you're checking out on that whole question of marriage and family. But this question of parental responsibility, politicians have said there's nothing really we can do about it. And I just don't think that's right, because there are things that have been proven to help parents who may be on a pathway towards not being responsible to get them back on track. There are specific things. I've written about them. I've worked on these kinds of things back in the day when I was working in the government. If you read my book, More Human, there's a lot about that in there. I'll give you a couple of examples. One is this. It's actually of all the social programs in the Western world that exist and have been evaluated for their effectiveness, the one that has been most of it, it's been around a long time, the one that's been most evaluated to be effective is something called the Nurse Family Partnership. And it was started in Colorado, actually, and it's been emulated in different ways all around the world. And it's a really interesting one because it takes if you can sort of picture a family that's, you know, really struggling, it may be a single mother on low income and with like really tough situation, really tough circumstances. She's trying to do her best, but it's like a terrible neighborhood and there's a lot going wrong. And so without some kind of help or an intervention, you could easily see that kind of parent just not behaving in the way that you'd want to see to raise a child in the way that we'd all expect. And most people do. And so the Nurse Family Partnership actually is an intervention where a nurse, a trained nurse, not a social worker, not a kind of government busybody, but an actual nurse, goes into the home and actually works with the parent, if it's just one, the parent, and if it's a couple, both of them, on really basic things about how to raise a child well. And I'll give you an example of things that you know, if you're just a sort of normal family and you think these things are completely normal. I remember working on these issues back in the day in the UK, going into a home where, I mean, the parent thought that it was perfectly reasonable. This is actually, I saw this with my own eyes. A kind of 2-year-old, 3-year-old, something like that, toddler, was strapped in front of a blaring television all day long with a bottle, like a kid's, you know, bottle that they drink out of, full of Coke, like Coca-Cola. You know, you just think, who would do that? It's so obviously crazy to normal people, but this didn't know any better. And actually, there's too much of that. It's, as I say, it's a minority, but it's a large minority. And and the way I often talk about it is, you have the minority of parents and families who have the most problems, and then who cause the most problems in terms of the way their children develop. There is something we can do about that. This program, Nurse Family Partnership, has a really good track record in a kind of non-judgmental, basic way, teaching parents how to be good parents. Just basic things like, this is how you get them to sleep. This is how you go to change a diaper. This is the kind of healthy routine that a child should have from a very early age. And if you get it right in the early stages, then that lasts a long time. So, you know, there's more that I could talk about. We've discussed some of these before on the show, and as I said, I've written about them. And I'm really interested in this. I'm really focused on it because it's one of those things where if you get this right, you save yourself a lot of time, money, problems later down the line. So this question of parental responsibility that was so much in the conversation this week as a kind of cultural talking point, actually, it is a policy question, and there is something we can do about it, and we should.
All right, joining us for California Corner today, Jen Horn, AM 870, The Morning Answer. And most importantly this week, the host, the convener of the amazing event that I had the great honor and privilege to be at, and the great fun and pleasure too, the Unite IE conference that you put together with Grant, with your colleagues in Ontario. This Sunday, I literally got off a plane from Japan from my week away with my family, and I went there and I was energized. It was such a great event. You've done the 10th one, right? The 10th anniversary. Tell us what your thoughts on the event.
Yeah. And just to give you a little history, because I think it's unique, and I think it's unique to people who are listening to the show right now. And that is, you know, so oftentimes people who listen in California or anywhere, if you're of a certain political persuasion, you might feel a little lonely. You might feel like there's a lot of crazy out there and there's maybe nothing you can do to fix it. And so the Unite IE Conservative Summit was actually founded about 10 years ago by my former radio partner, Don Dix, who was an activist who didn't start out that way. But after 9/11 and then after a few other things, you know, people stumble their way into activism. And he saw that there were a lot of groups that were operating kind of in their own spheres. And he thought, what if I took all of these groups that share similar ideologies and I put them all together into one coalition so that we can actually make real change? And so he created the Unite IE Coalition. And he got all of these groups on one page, and he created this event 10 years ago. And unfortunately, 2 years ago, he passed away, but it has been my pleasure and my honor to help him carry on the tradition of this event to get people energized and activated and realizing that we can make a difference and that it starts with us, that we've got to be part of the process if we want to make real change. And so this year's event, I think, was spectacular. It was huge. We had 800 people in the room. And when you consider California and consider most of our talks were about conservative principles, that's a really great number. And we were energized. And I feel like it was great. We started with Charlie Kirk, who talked a lot about 2024 from a national perspective. You were fantastic talking about California and about saving our state and getting energized, which I think people really needed to hear. Larry Elder was there answering questions from the crowd, totally interactive. We had a DA's panel, yeah, which I thought was super interesting, with DA Mike Heshron from Riverside and Jason Anderson from San Bernardino, Nathan Hochman, who's running against George Gascon. A lot of that focused on fentanyl and that crisis, and of course, the amendment to Prop 47. So that was great. We had a pastor's panel, and then you also came back. You were a hard worker with your jet lag, Steve Hilton. And we had our big panel with Assemblyman Bill Asaley, Officer Brandon Tatum, Dr. Sebastian Gorka. And we talked about California. We talked about national issues. And what I thought was most fascinating was listening to you and Sebastian Gorka talk about your experience as immigrants to this country, why you came here, what the country has sort of become, and why we want to fight to save it so that people do still see us as that shining light.
And I'll share something that is really interesting. So, you know, I've met Seb Gorka a few times, and you know, he's been on my show. I've been, you know, we sort of know each other a little bit, but we haven't really hung out. And yeah, the interesting thing was we both ended up telling a story. I think I told it first, but then he kind of said, "Oh my goodness, that's exactly what we had exactly the same experience, because not only are we both immigrants, we're Hungarians."
Right.
His parent, you know, we're both from Hungarian
families. Via the UK, which I think is so interesting.
Very similar trajectory. Yeah. Identical, actually. And I told this story, which I don't know if I've actually told on this show. I've told it before, which is when we first got here. So we moved here in 2012 from England. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that people on, you know, conservatives and Republicans would often say in response to Democrat policies at the time, Obama and so on, oh, that's communist. They'd use the word communist. That's communist.
Right.
I remember thinking, you know, honestly, that's over the top. I know communists, right? My family lived under communism. I used to go I saw it with my own eyes and so on. That's a little bit over the top. And, you know, you call it socialist, call it big government, whatever, but the communist bit much. And the interesting thing is, over the years, you know, I found myself recalling a story when I was a kid walking around our hometown in Hungary, Szeged, with my two cousins and like mucking about and saying sort of anti, you know, sort of shouting things that were, you know, being rude about the then leader of Hungary, the communist leader of Hungary, a guy called Janos Kada. and my aunt that night took me to one side in Hungary, and I remember it so clearly. She said, "Look, you can say all that in England, that's fine. And I know you're just joking, but here you can't say that kind of stuff. You know, your cousins would really get in trouble. And I could lose my job if just because you said that on the street. You just can't say things like that." And then I remember remembering that. And now here we are in America, you know, decades later, and people today are frightened of saying things in a public forum. People have lost their jobs for saying the wrong thing. I have people working in the top, you know, in major corporations that tell me that they definitely can't say what they think about current events or political things because they're frightened that they'll lose their job, they won't get promoted. That's a very common thing now. And that's America, you know, today.
I know.
And that word, and it's the same dynamic as a communist country in the 1970s. And so, and Seb had the same thought. He said, you know, he would actually laugh at people and say, that's ridiculous, when they were exactly the same as me. He said, but now the authoritarianism, the totalitarianism we see, it is the same mindset. And it's so interesting that we both had that progression from thinking it was a ridiculous thing to say to now saying, no, it is. I think he put it most succinctly. He said, no, communism is here today in America.
You can feel it. And how crazy is it? I mean, I never in a million years thought, Steve, in this country that I love, the country I've grown up in, the state that I grew up in California, listening to Charlie Kirk, who said, if there is not a risk that you might go to jail for something that you said, well, then you're not really in the game. Think about that. We're supposed to celebrate our freedom of speech. And now that we have a weaponized system of justice, those things are being used against us.
Yeah.
And whether it's taking away our social media account or making us lose our job or, God forbid, even being thrown in jail in some cases, this is not the country that we love. That's why we have to do everything to be part of the process to save it. Because if we get complacent, we lose it and we got to fight for it. It's worth it. I think it's worth fighting for our country.
Yeah, it's interesting because when you asked the question of us on the panel, you know, what's the greatest threat that we face? I think it was Bill Esaley who said apathy. Was it Bill? I think so.
And then everyone said,
you know, the fact, you know, and he made a very strong point and we all agreed, you know, you can't sit back. You have to get involved. You really do. And that was a really powerful theme, I think, from the whole event. And of course, the fact that people were there and together as a kind of force, I think was really powerful.
Yeah, people need to be told what to do because there's a lot of confusion. And I think that this is true for Democrats and Republicans. When you think about getting involved in the process, people never know exactly what to do. And especially if you're a conservative in California, as we talked about with the speech issues, you're like, well, do I want to say anything? Do I want my car scratched up? You know, all of these things. And so I think the thing that I took away is that the time for being silent is over. We have to be brave. We have to be optimistic, but we have to talk to people and we have to encourage people to get involved because the apathy is what will ruin us because people think they don't know what to do. So they just don't do anything. And that's a real problem.
Yeah, it's exactly right. That's why events like that are so important. Give people the confidence and the comradeship, which is what we need. To use a slightly communist word there. Comrade.
Yeah, right? But it was great. And you did such a great job. And I really appreciate you being there, especially with jet lag. Holy smokes, you've been a traveling machine.
I know. It's crazy. I can't wait to get home. I'm in Austin, Texas right now. All the eclipse. Very impressive. It was better than I thought. I know we were chatting about this. I should tell my little eclipse story.
I hope you
about
do.
The chickens.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I was not particularly excited about the eclipse, whatever, in the eclipse.
But I gave you glasses.
Yeah, exactly. And so I was coming to Austin anyway. A friend of mine had an eclipse party. He said, come earlier than I was planning to. So I did that. And actually, it was amazing. And the thing I loved the most, because we were, what's it called? The path of totality, which is such as a ridiculous term. Anyway, we were there in the path of totality. So it did go dark for a few minutes. And the thing that I loved was the chickens. So the chickens thought it was nighttime. And I have chickens at home. So I love chicken behavior is very interesting to me. And I think they're cute. You know, they went to sleep. They sort of started roosting and go very quiet. And then 4 minutes later, the sun comes out again. They start, you know, crowing and making all the noise. Oh my God, it's already morning.
They were like, this is the worst night's sleep I've ever had. They were like you. They slept for 4 minutes.
Exactly. The chickens had the equivalent of jet lag. It was very funny. So I did like the clip. It was amazing, actually. It really was. I'm very glad I saw it. It was very, kind of moving. Plus, actually, to our earlier point, it was nice that it was a party and people were there. It was just a kind of cool thing to experience as a group. I liked
it. Yeah, I think it was really neat. And I had a lot of listeners who called the show who said they were really upset that the media told them how to feel about the eclipse, which I thought was a funny take. I guess everybody's like, wow, this is life changing. look, I am all about space stuff. And it's a great reminder that we are just a small piece of the puzzle on Earth when you see things like this. But I think it's funny that a lot of folks were like, gosh, the media went so crazy and bananas that we're just, you know, it was cool to see, but come on.
The best bit was the, and when you talk about the media, the funniest thing was what's her name? Sunny Hostin on The View.
Oh, man.
Trying to make out that the eclipse and the earthquake were yet more examples of climate change.
It must be. Climate change.
I know. But even the other, even Joy Behar, if you said, no, actually, Whoopi
Goldberg. At some point, come
on. No, it's not. And in fact, the best bit was, because she said the earthquake was climate change, and Joy Behar quietly said, well, hang on a second, earthquakes come from underground.
Like, right. But you know what? It sounds like everything. I like to blame everything on climate change now. You've got your coffee that's too cold. Climate change.
So let's blame our first California story on climate change. So this, by the way, they probably will. This is a story you pointed out to me, which is just so symptomatic of the mentality of the people running California now, which is the closure of 99-cent stores.
Yeah.
And what's their response?
So this is a story. The 99-cent only store is closing down. And it's closing not just in California, but in Arizona, Nevada, Texas. I think the liquidation sales are already underway. But the funny part of this story, and I actually thought that some rich investor should have come in and changed it to the Joe Biden $9.99 only store, just to make sure he owns the inflation that we're all feeling, which is why these stores aren't in business. But the LA County Board of Supervisors this week, I had to read the story twice because I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. Janice Hahn, on Tuesday of this past week, had this meeting, and she said, you know, we've got a lot of employees, hundreds of employees, who are going to be out of work because the 99-cent only store is closing. So we're going to commission a study, which makes my head explode already. We're going to commission a study to figure out what services we can offer these people who are going to be out of work. You have to have a study. And then she said, and some of the things we might think about are job training. We might think about expenses to try to help them get back on their feet or to hold them over until they can get another job. Okay, we already have a welfare system in place. We already have unemployment. We should have on-the-job training. Okay, that's fine. You want to offer that. But do we really need a study? Because all you're going to do is spend more money to commission this study when you could actually implement policies to make it easier for businesses to operate in California.
Exactly.
It's reduce regulations, help the businesses. But oh no, we're going to do a study about it.
It's so, but the reason it's such an important story, and that we should use the, you know, these things, they tell us something important.
Yeah.
And you can say, it's a small thing, the 99-cent. But no, because it really reveals the mentality, which is that they truly are not interested in solving the problems. And you see, it's the same mentality I've talked about this before in relation to things like the minimum wage. So they say, and the ultimate expression of this was Barbara Lee, in that debate where she said, well, you know, maybe we should have a $50 minimum wage. And she wasn't even joking.
No.
She's like, well, but why did she say that? She said, well, look at the cost of living is really high for people and, you know, they need more money. I said, yeah, they do need more money. Why is the cost of living so high? Because of your stupid policies. Mm-hmm. So that's why everything is so expensive. Housing is so expensive because we're not building enough and what we build is too expensive because of the union deals that they put on there that make it incredibly expensive. The, fact that you've got the environmental regulations, the zoning rules, all these kinds of all these policies that make it incredibly expensive. If you look at the regulations on business, they drive up the cost of labor, the cost of materials, the cost of running your business, the compliance with all these endless rules, the lawsuits that businesses have to put money aside to pay because they've empowered the union. You know, on and on. Right? We have the worst business climate in America. We are 50th out of 50. So how about doing something about that?
Instead of
solving the problem, they are saying, well, let's deal with the consequences of the problem.
Yeah.
But that itself makes the problem worse because if you raise the minimum wage, that raises the cost for the businesses. So that just keeps the cycle of things getting more and more expensive going in an upward direction.
It's like hitting yourself in the head and putting a Band-Aid on instead of just stop hitting yourself in the head. I mean, this is what they're doing. And it was very interesting because Bernie Sanders came to town this week. He was in downtown LA and he was out walking with one of the unions, Unite Here or something, I think is what it was called. And he was out there walking with these hotel workers. You probably have heard the hotel workers have been trying to unionize. Half of them got a deal. They're making $35 an hour minimum wage now. The other half have not. So Hotel Figueroa is one of the hotels that haven't. They also fired 100 employees who complained publicly about them not wanting to raise their minimum wage. So Bernie's out there and he says, well, these people deserve a decent wage. They deserve decent health care. They deserve a decent path to living. They deserve a decent pension. So my question to Bernie is, what's decent? Like, what does that even mean? What is decent? Because if you don't think that the Hotel Figueroa is decent, then you should go find a job somewhere else. Let that hotel decide what they want to offer to get their the best possible people. And if people don't want to work for that, then guess what? They're going to have to up their ante a little bit.
Yes.
They don't understand that free market is the solution. It's not the unions. It's not this forced minimum wage. It's absolutely ridiculous.
And I've always said, okay, fine. We want people to be well paid. We're pro-worker. Very strongly, you know, and as the Republican Party becomes more and more the party of the working class, which is happening, I think we need to emphasize that. We want people to be paid well.
Sure.
But the way you do that is to have a dynamic, fast-growing economy where businesses can be set up and thrive and grow and so on. And even, you know, I've argued in the past for what I call the business-friendly living wage, which is, okay, fine. Let's say pay a living wage. That's fine. But don't do it in by forcing these burdens on the company, because that means they'll end up just having to fire people or go out of business. Here's a way you can do it to cut the taxes that businesses pay. They keep piling on the payroll taxes and all the other taxes that make it more expensive. Well, here's it. Well, you know, you can just take out the government. If you just remove all those taxes and have, then you free up money, as it were, from the businesses. They're no longer paying those taxes. Then they can pay people more. But without doing that, it's just you're all you're doing is putting companies out of business, making them leave the state. That's why, by the way, what's the data we saw last week? California, the highest unemployment rate in the country, the lowest job growth, highest unemployment rate because of these policies. It's so stupid and self-defeating. But you said it best. It's like hitting yourself in the head and getting the bat. It's such a brilliant analogy. It's just true.
They're feeding a vicious cycle and they don't even realize it because the people who we elect have never had jobs. They've never actually had to do anything where they're running a business where they actually talk and understand the challenges that businesses face. And I am not anti-worker. I am pro-worker. I want everybody to have the salary that they want and that they work for. But I don't think we feed an entrepreneurial spirit when we start looking with the term decent. When Bernie Sanders is out there talking about decent wages, decent. I mean, it's like it just feels so anti-American when I hear that. And I don't want to say commie because we've already established that that's not appropriate.
Exactly. So talking of, I don't know how to even, you know, capture my fury at the next story. I guess it's a story that, I mean, so much like this first one where they just keep doing the same thing with the same terrible results. But it's just so infuriating. It kind of brought it to a head, made it very visible about homelessness. We've talked about this many times before. They spent all this money and the problem just gets worse. But now we have an official state audit that was published, $24 billion. Mm-hmm. And this is not some, you know, conservative think tank or newspaper or whatever, Fox News. This is this official state auditor saying they have no idea what the money was spent on. They have no idea what works, what doesn't work.
And yet they're asking for more.
For more.
It's infuriating.
And the amount of, and the only thing we do know is that while they've been spending this $24 billion, the number of homeless people has gone up.
Yeah. And so this is the thing. And I know that we've talked about it here. I scream about it all the time. I don't want people to live and die on the streets of Los Angeles. I feel bad for them. I feel bad for us. I feel bad for our kids. It is a lose-lose situation to have the homeless crisis that we do on the streets. I'd be willing to spend money on this if I actually thought the money was working. But the money is not working. We've passed sales tax. We've taken out bonds. This recent Prop 1 is more money to go to homelessness. All it's doing is feeding the friends of our elected politicians who set up these nonprofit, so-called government-run organizations that are contracted out by the government. They set up these things and the money disappears and people are still suffering. And it this should infuriate every single one of us, whether we are a Democrat, a Republican, somewhere in between, because we are trusting people and allowing them to take more money from us to help folks who are never seeing it. And this story, I just pulled it up because I want to make sure it's right. And you brought the number up, $24 billion to tackle homelessness over a five-year period, but they didn't track the outcomes. They didn't track the effectiveness of the programs, according to the state audit. They tried to figure out how effective all these initiatives and how these billions of dollars were being used, whether there was an effectiveness. No, they say 171 people are still, or 171,000 people are still homeless in California, which is 30% of all homeless people in the United States. And Steve, that number is low. I would imagine we're probably at 171,000 in LA County, not in the entire state of California.
That's low, exactly. Yeah. And there has to be a point where we just really make it very clear to the voters, unless you vote for change, you're going to get the same outcome,
because this is
what we've been seeing on all of these issues, the same problems, the same kinds of approaches being taken, and the same disastrous results, and actually, you know, getting worse, not better.
Yeah. And we need to allow any programs that are going to be set up to use and be entrusted with taxpayer money. They need to be sure that there is an accounting of where that goes. They need to be sure that the idea of the no-bid contract is gone. We need people to bid on this work. And also, we need to understand that this is not just about things that dollars can solve. We need people who are willing to give these homeless people a choice. Either you have, number one, you have to get off the street. You can't live on the street. And if you are in trouble with the law, you need a choice to go to treatment. And we have to initiate that. It is tough love, but it has to be done. Dr. Drew Pinsky is not political, but he is someone who has said that we have to figure out ways that we can compel people to go into treatment. And this is what has to happen, because the people who are living on the street, we've not only incentivized people to come here and be like a vagabond on the streets of Los Angeles, but we have so much mental illness, so much drug and alcohol addiction.
Yeah.
We have to fix it. That's the humane thing to do.
Of course
it's not humane to leave people out on the streets. Ugh.
So we've got a conversation in this episode with Lisa Smitkamp, who's the DA of Fresno County, on the Reform Prop 47 initiative.
Sure.
And she gets into that. Very important conversation. And it's so true. By the way, just as you, I mean, I remember back in the day working when we're in the UK government with the policy reform program. I need to go back and see how well it was implemented, but we had a very clear concept for some of these services that taking in a lot of money from the government. It was called payment by results. We even had a three-letter acronym for it, which means it definitely was real. In the civil service, if you have a three-letter acronym, that means it's real. So PBR, payment by results, PBR
right.
programs. And so, for example, I do remember we applied it to prison rehabilitation as well, to stop recidivism. So people would, you know, so you had a contract to a private company to manage the probation, and when people come out of jail, and they were only paid, well, their contract specified certain milestones had to be met to get their money as a contractor. And I do remember for the prisons, it was the final installment. For the the company providing the service, they'd only get paid if the guy or woman in jail had been in a job for more than 12 months.
Wow.
So the ultimate kind of success measurement was if you've been in jail, was getting someone in a job, because the job was a proxy for getting your life back on track. If you can hold down a job for a year, that means you really have turned a corner. And so the agency, the company being paid for the service, that was their measure to get their final installment of their money. At least that was the theory. I'd left by the time it was really fully implemented, but that was definitely how it was designed, or how we intended it to be designed.
I think we also have to really stop kidding ourselves, and that the idea that you can sleep on the street, it's not legal. We already have laws on the books.
It should be zero. The number of people sleeping on the street should be zero.
we don't enforce that. And so people think they can sleep on the street. I'm not sure if I told you this, I may not have shared. I live in the San Fernando Valley in California. I live in a mountainous community, which means that a lot of times people will use the streets to go up into the mountains, the homeless people, they'll live there, they'll camp there. And I came home just a couple of weeks ago and there was a woman on the sidewalk that I literally thought was dead. And I looked at her and I was like, oh God, what am I going to do about that? I go inside the house. I was trying to figure out if I should call the police because I figured they wouldn't come. And all of a sudden I hear the sirens outside my window. Woo woo. And I look out and I see a fire truck pulls up. And I thought, great, this woman's going to get the help they need. Basically, they woke her up and they found out she was alive. They said, are you okay? She said, yes. They got back in their truck and they took off and left her to go back to sleep on the street.
Oh my goodness.
Now, that is not going to end the problem. That only incentivizes the problem. And so until we start changing the ability for allowing law enforcement to start doing their job and start enforcing the no camping rules, we're never going to have an end to this. Yes, we can deal with mental illness and addiction, but we have to start, number one, first and foremost, with enforcing the laws on the books to ensure that people aren't living out there.
And then when they say, I mean, look, I sort of talked about it just now in relation to this Biden kind of picking and choosing which court rulings he's going to ignore or not. But you have to say, like, he set a precedent. I mean, the reason that's given by all these authorities in California and elsewhere for not enforcing the no camping ordinances is, well, we can't because there's a Supreme Court ruling, the Boise ruling, that says you're not allowed to if you don't have sufficient shelter beds, blah, blah, blah. And then now that's going back to the Supreme Court with Grants Pass and Oregon, all these cases and whatever. We'll see what happens. But that's the reason they give. Oh, we can't. Our hands are tied. It's the law. Well, if it's okay for Biden to totally ignore the Supreme Court in relation to student debt, why, you know, what's the difference here?
Right.
I mean, he's set a precedent now of just ignoring the law.
The
now,
Supreme
I'm not,
Court.
I'm not advocating for that, but I'm just saying, if we're going to do that, let's at least do it for something so egregiously unacceptable. People sleeping on the streets.
Yeah. And I also read a story. You probably missed this one. I mean, it gets so ridiculous that now, you know, if you're not living on the street, chances are you might have an RV. We've talked about the problem around LA where people have these hunk of junk RVs that look like
Soledad,
they don't even have tires.
She's on the, you know, the advisory board for Golden Together, my organization. She's fantastic. She has one, like literally the guy outside her house that could see into her house and he's sort of flashing and, you know, walking around with nothing on and like she has to sort of shut the curtains in her own house because of this guy.
They're putting these huge cement blocks up on LA streets now to try to prevent these campers from parking because not only is it an RV that's an eyesore, but then they build an encampment onto the RV. And so stunning. Now the city of Los Angeles is trying to rent public land from Caltrans, from the state of California, to park these RVs to store them for people.
It's just ridiculous.
This is not how you fix the problem. The problem is you say, if you can't camp on Nordoff in the San Fernando Valley, you just can't do it. Camp at a camping ground. You can't camp here.
But, by the way, I must get her on to talk about it. Soledad, she had this amazing story of where she tried to get the city council. She's in Venice. She tried to get the city council to do something about it. And they said, well, we can't because there's no signs on the street saying no RV parking. So she said, well, there are, because on the main boulevards in Venice, there are signs. So it's obviously the case. And she said, but there isn't one on your street. It's a side street. And she said, okay, great. Well, put one up. And she said, we can't put one up. You, the resident, have to go around and get a petition and have more than 50% of the local residents sign a petition to get us to put a sign up for what the law already is. I just think, what kind of mad world are we in? It's just like
back to the residents. I know. it makes you wonder when you go to these electeds too for help, like the city council or whatever it might be. I mean, I laughed about this guy. You probably saw it. It went viral. The guy who had 700 tons of garbage in his yard, and the poor neighbors are like going to the city council. They're going to Karen Bass, the mayor of LA. They're going all over the place because it stinks. Quite literally, it stinks, and they're being ignored. And so finally, it gets picked up by the media. And then what do you know? 700 tons of garbage is pulled out of this guy's house. And Karen Bass comes out and says, oh, well, we didn't know. You know, I'm new here. She says, like, I'm the mayor of Los Angeles, but I'm new here. And we'll investigate why these claims went unanswered. They go unanswered because unless you are the loudest of the squeaky wheels, you're not going to get the services that you deserve. And we spend so much to live here.
I know. It's so broken, all of it. Oh,
very frustrating. But, you know, we are going to. We're going to make the change happen. I'm very confident of that.
Step by step.
Exactly. And this conversation is part of it. Jen, great to see you as always. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
So joining us for Candidate Corner today is someone who's not actually a candidate right now, but is leading an incredibly important election effort, which is the effort to reform Prop 47. We all know about the notorious Prop 47 and all the problems it has caused. But the person who we can thank if we managed to deal with it is my guest today, District Attorney Fresno County, Lisa Smitkamp. Lisa, how are you doing?
Hello, I'm doing great, and I'm only one of many. So yes, I'm happy to be here to talk about the fixed Prop 47 reform.
Okay, so let's get right to the kind of substance of it. Tell us about what, just tell us, you know, I think we all know it's become very notorious, as I say, Prop 47, but just tell us in your account, you know, what really have been the consequences of Prop 47 and how you got to the point of the success you have today where we are on the brink of being able to vote for this reform package in November.
Okay. So Prop 47, as many people know, was passed in 2014 and it was really sold under the ballot title, you know, Safe Schools and Neighborhoods. And so people, really good people have voted for it, thinking that it was going to be this, you know, great cost savings for the state of California. But I think people who were on the inside of the criminal justice system knew that it was going to be a disaster, and it turned out to be just that. So it completely took away police and prosecutors' ability to hold drug addicts and thieves accountable. And it has had so many, you know, overreaching negative things that have happened to communities. And there has not been any money that has come to any counties that I'm aware of in savings, which was the whole proponent of it at the beginning. So Prop 47 in and of itself has been a failure, and it has taken us a decade for people to really understand that it's not just about the criminal justice system wanting to throw people in jail and get convict people of felonies. It's really about health and wellness and people who are suffering from addictions and people who continue to just steal things without any responsibility or accountability in the criminal justice system is not good for our society. So the District Attorneys Association, led by our CEO, Greg Totten, and then one of our retired DAs, Anne-Marie Schubert, they have really been the leaders in this. And, you know, Jeff Reisig and Vern Pearson and myself and Cindy Zimmer from Kern County, we've kind of jumped on the bandwagon as well as many other elected DAs to kind of lead the charge and really try to work with small business owners who really are at the crux of most of this. And some of the large corporations obviously have been a tremendous help to us. And we have very successfully raised a lot of money to get some paid signature gatherers. And there's been a lot of grassroots efforts, too, for people to sign petitions. And we are getting ready here to come now at the end of April to the end of the period where we can gather the signatures and getting ready to turn them over to the Secretary of State, where we're very confident that we have enough signatures to get this initiative on the ballot for November.
So that is the initiative will be on the ballot in November, we hope, and you sound very confident. I mean, I've just been watching the numbers tick up, hundreds of thousands, you know, 100,000 this week, then 200,000, over 700,000 now. That's all fantastic. Tell us about the actual reform package, because some people, you know, over the last few years, as you say, it's become more and more apparent the harm that's being caused by Prop 47. You heard a lot of people say the answer to, or part of the answer to the crime problem in California, particularly retail theft, repeal Prop 47. Now, this package isn't repeal, is it? Tell us what is in the initiative that you're about to get on the ballot.
Okay, that's correct. It's not a cancellation of Prop 47, although there's many people, you know, in the criminal justice system that would like that to happen. That is really not where we are. What we're doing right now is we are taking the opportunity to really aggregate crimes. That's sort of the crux of it. So under this act, the Homelessness, Theft, and Drug Addiction Reduction Act, we are going to be able to say if people have suffered two convictions for a theft crime, the third time they can be charged as a felony. And those ramifications are good because it addresses repeat offenders. And it will then give the prosecutors the ability to charge a felony and to then, you know, hopefully have people put on felony probation so that they can have some supervision and really sort of have a little bit more of a stick. Because in the misdemeanor world, when you just have one misdemeanor after the other, after the other, after the other, because of all of the jail overcrowdings and prison closures that we have in California, there's really no way to punish people for misdemeanors anymore in the state of California. So this will raise the people who choose to continue to steal up to the level of being felons and give us a little bit more ability to have some accountability for theft. The second thing is that it enhances the same type of system for drug addiction and drug use. So people who are convicted of possession of drugs two times as a misdemeanor, the third time that they are charged, they can be arrested and charged, they can be charged with a felony. And the important thing about that felony charge, which hopefully would result in some kind of a conviction, is when they are convicted, then they will be mandated to treatment. So that is really the crux of why this part of it is so important, is because when Prop 47 was passed and all these drug crimes were reduced to misdemeanors, what the state didn't do was provide treatment for people for those misdemeanor charges or allegations. And they really failed people in that. So you have people that had drug addictions that did not get treatment other places from family or churches or private nonprofits, and they ended up in the criminal justice system. And then they came there with an addiction and there was no stick there either. There was no impetus to create a bottom for them and no treatment. And so you just had people then that then became, you know, thieves and more serious domestic violence or more serious armed robbers to feed their addiction. And so it actually, Prop 47 actually created problems for many addicts. And then the third part of it, sorry to be so wordy, but the third part of it is to increase penalties for fentanyl and fentanyl dealers. And because, as you know, fentanyl has become a public health crisis and it is more addictive and more dangerous. It's a poison, quite honestly. Synthetic fentanyl is something that is ruining our nation. It is killing. I mean, it's like it's tantamount to having an airliner go down every day. Right. We have hundreds of people a day in the United States of America that are dying of fentanyl overdoses. And so it has to be, we have to treat fentanyl different because it is different. And so this would increase the penalties for fentanyl.
Really interesting. I want to dive into certainly the first two. I mean, the fentanyl one, super clear. I wanted to ask a couple of questions on the first two. Let's go in reverse order. With the mandated treatment, that sounds really important because you're getting to the root causes of the problem, as it were. That drives this persistent crime. How does it interact with other stuff that we may have heard about that issue? For example, Gavin Newsom touting the care courts. I think it seemed to have been designed with that kind of idea in mind, you know, prescribing treatment. How does the content of this measure, how would it interact with everything else that's going on?
So, you know, I call Governor Newsom Governor Soundbite because right. That's does. He creates soundbites and he speaks so authoritatively and he's so smooth in front of the camera, right? And I'm sure that the people that vote for him honestly believe what he's saying. But the bottom line at the end of the day, Steve, is that Gavin Newsom has no idea what goes on in the court of law. He has no idea what goes on the streets with regard to people who are suffering from these addictions and need this treatment. So I have a hard time with him, you know, touting these care courts because we have courts in California. We have had drug courts for many years that did what tried to do what Prop 47 was touted to do, right? Was give people an opportunity to get clean. We had PC 1000, we had Prop 36 drug court. We had all kinds of opportunities for people to get clean. And we had about a 20 to 25% success rate in those courts because getting over drug addiction is a very hard thing. What Gavin Newsom and Prop 47 has done, it has created so many other issues where drug addicted people are creating so many more felonies and there is no more room in the jail to have care courts. Because if you have a court of law and you bring people into care courts and you say, okay, we're going to dismiss these charges against you if you get clean and sober. If they don't get clean and sober, there has to be penalty for them. And a lot of the times, the only penalty for people that are in that life where they're stealing, they're drugging, they're stealing credit cards of their families, they've alienated their friends and their coworkers, and they've lost their jobs. The only thing left is sometimes incarceration. Sometimes that can be overnight. Sometimes that can be 2 weeks. Sometimes it could be 30 days or 60 days for them to create that bottom. sometimes the criminal justice system does create that bottom for addicts when nothing else has worked. But because of his prison closures and because of AB 109, because of all the other policies, we don't have that. So he, in effect, with all of his other policies, has neutered the ability to have a drug court be effective. Because basically, he's turned narcotics officers and narcotics prosecutors and judges who are trying to help people get on that path, he's turned them into social workers. And nothing against social workers, because there is a great need for that. There's a great need for addictive recovery and social work and psychology and therapy in the world of addiction, but that's not court. So he has really taken the sticks. He's taken all the sticks away for us when we are trying to, be a little more heavy-handed with the people who don't get with the program the first, second, or third time. Because every county in California had the opportunity for people to do drug courts, but drug courts really don't exist anymore. In fact, I believe Fresno County is one of the only counties that still has, a very, small drug court. Because when you have people who are addicted to cocaine or methamphetamine or now fentanyl, and you encounter them in the street, and you give them a traffic ticket, which I always call like a party invitation, right? Who's going to come? People who are drug addicted and it's a misdemeanor and there's no stick, or they know that once they're cited to go to court in 30 days, they're addicted. They're out on the street. They care about getting high. They're not putting that in their calendar to be in court in 30 days. So what happens is they fail to appear. Their addiction continues. It gets worse. We don't have the resources to go out and get them because we have nowhere to put them. Even if we were to arrest them on a misdemeanor failure to appear warrant for their misdemeanor citation for possession of fill-in-the-blank drug, there's nowhere to put them. You can't arrest someone on a warrant and then bring them to court and say, okay, don't do that again and go back out the door. That's not real. So that's why I have such a problem with Gavin Newsom, because he has no idea what he's talking about, and he misleads the people of the state of California every single time he does a press conference on one of these things. It's maddening for those of us in the system.
Okay, as we could see. So just to put that to one side. So the care court thing, it sounds like, which is much touted, that's a gimmick. It's kind of irrelevant to the real issues that we're dealing with.
It's just not feasible anymore in the situations that he's created.
Right. And so then let's go to the points you've just been making. AB 109, again, it's something that we talk about a lot. Just remind, was that the one that was in response to the Supreme Court ruling about overcrowding, and it meant that the county jails had all the federal prisoners in and then they had to be emptied? Is that what that was about?
No, what happened with AB 109 is the Supreme Court of the United States of America told the state of California that their prison population was excessive and they had to bring it down. And so instead of California responding in kind to say, okay, we have too many prisoners and not enough jails, we need to build more.
Right.
More prisons for bed space, they responded in the opposite way. And that was, we are going to now change the law. So after AB 109, there is now a list of enumerated subject matter crimes in the penal code for which people do not go to state prison. They do local prison time in a county jail. So now all of those felons who are prison ineligible serve time in the local jail. So that's why there is no room
for the kind of sanctions that you want to impose for these drug. Yeah.
So there's no more room for misdemeanor people who commit misdemeanors, right? Because sometimes you have a drunk driver, right, who has his or her first or second offense, and sometimes 30 days in jail, a sentence of 30 days in jail, which maybe they only serve 15, is enough of a wake up call to say, you know what, I have got to address my drinking problem. Because these are not hardened criminals. And no, it's not fun for anybody to spend 15 days in a jail. But if you've gone out and suffered two misdemeanor convictions for DUI, you've got a drinking problem. And if your church and your family and your wife and your boss hasn't been able to get to you, sometimes we have to resort to that. But in the state of California, there are very few counties that are able to incarcerate misdemeanor drunk drivers. So you know what happens to those misdemeanor drunk drivers? They continue. Because I will tell you, more people die in drunk driving accidents in many counties in California than they do gang violence or homicides or guns. And why is that? You ask yourself, it's because there's no accountability the first time and the second time. And the drinking continues and the behavior continues and there's no accountability. And then we have, deaths that occur because of this behavior.
So if you had your way and we had a sort of real anti-crime reform program, we would build more jails.
we would repeal AB 109 and restore the ability for those criminals to be put back into state prison where we'd have more space? Is that the sort of direction we would go?
So if you were to ask Lisa Smitkamp, what's her dream come true for California, is that we never need another prison. We can educate people and we can have jobs and we can send all of our young people out of the gangs and into schools and into productive jobs so that we don't need more prisons.
Right.
But we don't have that situation, right? We have more gun dealers, more traffickers, more people who want to traffic guns and drugs and women today than we've ever seen before. So yeah, we have a very serious crime problem in the nation, right? Not in California. But the way California's managed prison system is terrible. And the politics are such that, we have this sort of woke mentality that prison is only.
They call it decarceration. I mean, in fact, I do see Gavin Newsom and the Democrats being attacked from the left for saying that they're not shutting down enough prisons. They're going too slowly in ending jail.
And you know what, Steve? Prison is mean, but you have to be a really bad person. You have to do really bad things to get to prison in the state of California today. And so, all of these people who have all of this junk science that high police presence and the presence of law enforcement in communities doesn't deter crime, they're just wrong. Sadly, people believe all of these things. So yes, the state of California has increased everything, as far as I know, in the last 20 years. We are building more housing. We are building more hospitals. We have more stores. All of our services are increasing, but the politics say that we can't have more prisons. And so until that mentality changes, we are sort of going to be spinning in this cycle that we're in. And so prosecutors and police have been forced over the last decade to really change the way that we do things. For instance, I will tell you, I spend about 30 to 40% of my time going out to high school gyms and talking to children and young adults about the ills of fentanyl and how scary it really is. I'm not a teacher. That is not in my repertoire. I'm not trained for that, but I do it because I'm a mom and I know how hard it is with my knowledge, my education, my experience, and my work to educate my own children and their circle of friends about the ills of fentanyl. And I know what kids go through and how stressful life is today for them. So I feel like it's my passion now to try to share it with other teachers, educators, healthcare professionals. And we're very lucky that that has resulted in some good things here in Fresno, but not every DA has that. You have police all over the nation are forced to do community policing, right? And that's a good thing that the police get involved in their communities, but it does take resources away from other aspects of policing. And so we are all doing things differently to try to make our communities safe.
Yeah, they're workarounds from having a really properly functioning criminal justice system.
Well, yeah. And we're forced, they're taking the tools out of our toolbox every single day. So we're really trying to stay ahead of it. And we're trying to stay ahead of technology and the internet, the way criminals use that too. So we're challenged every single day.
So could you go back? I mean, I'd love to talk to you again about the broader question. I do want to come back to the 47 one, Prop 47. So while it's not going to fix all those problems we've just been discussing, the second part that you went through, the three parts, part three fentanyl, part two was the mandatory drug treatment. So that can be delivered within current capacity as a solution because it's not talking about jail. Is that, I just want to make sure I've understood that correctly in terms of the reform package.
I think that's the most important part of that is that people are going to be mandated. And again, once you are convicted of a felony and you have a felony conviction, that raises the ability of the probation department to be involved. It raises the ability, it raises the ramifications for you, raises the level of supervision that you will have when you are on felony probation. And hopefully it will encourage people, right, to do better things and to get involved in community rehab programs and whether they need inpatient or outpatient. And so we're hoping that that will do that. And our hope is that we don't have to send people, but if they don't get clean, then being a felon will give them the status to be incarcerated in the jail. Yes.
One number we haven't discussed yet. Does this get rid of the kind of the number that's become quite notorious nationwide now, the $950 per day?
No, it will not change the $950 threshold. And sadly, honestly, that threshold has elevated you know, over the nation. It's very commonplace for that to be the misdemeanor felony level now. And, you know, in my day, when I first became a prosecutor, it was $400. Anything over $400 was a felony. So I guess it's commiserate maybe with inflation. But what's important to know about the change that this legislation would bring is that after somebody has two misdemeanor convictions for stealing things under $950, that's the end. The third time, then they will be charged with a felony. And then again,
I see. So that's how we get to the goal. Very clear. Thank you.
Allows us to do that and to say, okay, this might still be a $500 theft, but it's a felony because you have these two qualifying priors.
So effectively, it's like, it's, rather than, you know, three strikes and you're out, it's three strikes and it's a felony is the sort of simple way of thinking about
your
it.
Your third theft will be a felony with two qualifying prior convictions.
Couple more points and then there will, just before I let you go, the first, it's true, isn't it, that these changes give better tools to prosecutors, but it does depend on having prosecutors who are going to use them. So if you have someone like a George Gascon, if he could still say, well, thanks guys for making these reforms. I'm not interested. I'm not charging these crimes.
That is correct. And you know, that's the thing, you know, Steve, I always like to tell the story. When I was elected, I had a child that was 9 years old and she said, Mom, now that you're the boss, do you have to go to work as much? And I said, I have to go to work more now that I'm the boss because it's that much more important for me to be there. Of course I have to go. And she said, well, who is your boss, Mommy? And I was driving down the street and I said, I don't have a boss anymore. I'm the boss, right? So when you have an elected person, whether it's the DA or any other elected, the sheriff, anyone, if I came to work tomorrow and sent a memo out and said, as effective today, we are not going to prosecute home invasion robberies in the county of Fresno, what could anybody do? The sheriff can't come in. The CAO can't come in. No one can come in and tell Lisa Smith can't because she's an elected person. So what would have to happen? A recall would have to happen. And that, as you know, is like a whole campaign. So the district attorney has tremendous power. Historically, those district attorneys have not abused that power until we had Soros-backed DAs, who I call imposter DAs, because I don't even address people like George Gascon or Pamela Price as District Attorney Gascon. He's George Gascon to me because he's an imposter DA. He is not there to uphold the law. He is not there to promote public safety. He is there to promote the agenda of the people who fill his coffers, just like Pamela Price.
Exactly. And the results are now clear. I mean, Pamela Price, Alameda County, right? And look at Oakland. I mean, it's just an absolute, I mean, it's just falling apart.
And you know, Steve, I think what the worst thing about these rogue imposter DAs is they are hurting the people they purport to help.
Exactly. So the point here is just because, you know, let's hope that this gets on the ballot, that's looking likely. I'm sure it will pass. Obviously, there'll be a strong campaign. I'm going to be fighting for it. But, you know, we've got some Democrat mayors even on board with it, Mayor of San Jose, Mayor of San Francisco, you know, like I'm feeling good about it.
Yeah.
But even then, you need crime fighting DAs. You can't just assume that this reform will do the job. The last question I have for you is, I don't even know if you've had time because you're busy doing your job to even look at it. I think this just, I read about this just yesterday. Democrats in the state legislature have proposed a package of bills, I believe six in total, that they say will achieve the goals of your initiative without needing to pass the initiative. What are they talking about?
More lies. So yes, I'm very well aware of that. That's been brewing for some time. I saw the press conference yesterday. And you know, the thing is if you really get into the weeds of Prop 47, the only way to sort of fix it is by proposition, which is why we're doing it the way that we're doing it. And I'll just let you know, there have been over 20 bills that have failed the Assembly and the Senate up until this point, right? So until this initiative gained so much strength and so much encouragement from the public, and we had people lining up literally to sign this petition, people literally donating money, corporations throwing money at it, saying, yes, we will. Yes, we want it. And so now these people in the legislature are saying, oh, no, we don't need that. And it's all Newsom and his people because they don't want to kill 47 and they don't want
to. They supported it. They're embarrassed because.
Of course, because then they have to admit failure. And not only do they have to admit the failure from the policy that they tried to implement, but they've been defending it, right, by their junk science and the stats that really do not reflect the reality of what goes on for 10 years. And what I mean by that is there are statistics that in certain counties that say, oh, this kind of crime is down, theft is down, drug use is down. Well, guess what? It's because people have lost so much faith in the system. They don't even call anymore because the police officers tell them when they come out, I can take this report for you, but I'm just going to tell you, no one's going to go to jail. And in some counties, the DA won't even prosecute misdemeanors anymore. They just don't do it because there's no purpose to it. You know, we could go on for hours and hours about the other things that have happened and how the legislature up in Sacramento has completely annihilated the ability to even put misdemeanors on probation. Many misdemeanor crimes have 1 year probation now. So it's over. Before they even get on and get on a path to doing anything productive, their probation is over. And then they're back to, you know, misdemeanor type crimes again. So it's time for the tides to change in California. And this
yes.
would potentially be the most important piece of public policy legislation that's passed in a decade.
Well, fantastic that you're here today to tell us about it, but more importantly, to do the work to make it happen. I'd love to talk to you more about all those other things. I mean, it's a big issue. It's the number one issue for so many people in our state. Also, if people watching and listening around the country, as well as in California, I bet they're saying, I wish we had a DA like you. Great to see you, Lisa.
I get a lot of offers to move to other jurisdictions, but I'm a Fresno girl born and raised, and I will never leave. So this is my home.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Lisa Smitkamp.
You're most welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. So I'm laughing already because this story is so ridiculous. This is what I want to get off my chest this week, which is about the attitude of government unions. We've talked about this before, but this is so ridiculous. You won't believe it. Here's the story. Here in California, Governor Gavin Newsom, this is a story I'm reading from Politico. The headline, ready or not, Newsom wants state workers back in the office. Here's the first line. After 4 years of remote work, Governor Gavin Newsom wants California's 240,000, by the way, nearly a quarter of a million state workers to return to their offices. The state workers are not taking it well. By the way, they are asking the workers to come in, wait for it, 2 days a week, 2 days a week, starting June the 17th. And what's the reaction from the unions, the government unions that represent this army of busybodies and bureaucrats? No, we're not doing it. No way. 2 days a week? Are you kidding? This is a direct quote from a guy called Tim O'Connor, president of CASE, C-A-S-E, a union representing state attorneys and judicial workers. Direct quote. Obviously, we're not happy with it. Obviously. Yeah, obviously. 2 days a week. Are you mad? Obviously, that's crazy. You can't expect us to come in the office 2 days a week. I mean, it's just unbelievable, just the language. Obviously, we're not happy with it. And they're gonna fight these return to office mandates. And there's another union here saying there's no way that we're going to do this. And they're complaining about the additional financial burden that comes with going into the office. I mean, yes, like normal people across the country. I mean, it's just so absolutely ridiculous. And you've got the mayor of Sacramento. Obviously, a lot of these workers are in Sacramento, the state capital, and just making the point that actually, you know, the fact that they're not coming in and it's such a big employer in Sacramento, it's a huge impact on the city, on downtown and all the things we know, you know, like restaurants and coffee shops and sandwich, all this business that's been lost when people don't come into offices. Never mind the aspect of productivity and creativity and just the humanity of people working together on a team and so on. No, absolutely out of the question. Not even for 2 days a week. 2 days a week is too much for these government workers. They just want to sit at home all day. By the way, this comes in the week, as we discussing earlier, where the state auditor has revealed that these government programs that these people are supervising just waste billions and billions and billions of dollars of taxpayer money on programs where no one knows what works, what doesn't work. I mean, just endless examples of the complete, you know, failure of these government workers to do their job properly. But what they really care about is being able to stay at home all the time. and do their jobs from home. And the idea that they that Gavin Newsom wants to sort of get them in into the office for 2 days a week, let's conclude with that sentence again, which is just so stunning. Obviously, we're not happy with it. Well, obviously, we're not happy with you lot. For goodness sake, what planet are you on? All right, that is our show for today. Hope you enjoyed it. Remember that the next episode of Big Ideas Book Club with Brad Wilcox talking about the importance of marriage, what's going on with marriage and why it's such a foundational institution in our society and what we need to do to try and strengthen it. Fantastic conversation. That's coming out on Monday, Big Ideas Book Club. I hope you're following that show and all our interesting conversations there. And of course, make sure you come back here for the next episode of The Steve Hilton Show. We'll be back next week. Follow us on Apple, YouTube, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts.